Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Drew Deitch. Today we are talking all about sleepwalkers. If you haven't heard of this one, that's probably okay because it doesn't stem from a novel or a short story that we know of. As far as Drew and I know, it's an original screenplay from Stephen King, and I think these are a little less popular. I just recently talked about Golden Years as well, which was written strictly for TV and also wasn't my favorite thing, but I think maybe Sleepwalkers was a little bit better than that. Drew, have you seen Golden Years?
No, I know that's like a mini series, or was like trying to be a television series, like kind of a kickoff to something. And does that tie into his whole like the shop mythology?
Yes, it does. The shop is pretty prominent in about, I would say, 2/3 of it. But then you just have this story that, like you said, it was supposed to be like a full season of TV, but then it ended up just being 7 or 8 episodes. It was like 4 hours, and 4 hours was way too long for the story. So I don't know how they would have done a whole season. But Sleepwalkers, at least you can get in and out of this one. And I know you're a little more fond of it than most. So why don't we dive into that a little? What is it about Sleepwalkers that you find enjoyable?
Well, I'll cop to it being a significant chunk of it being pure nostalgia. This is a movie that was seemingly always on television when I was a kid. I want to feel like it's one of those movies that like the Turner networks had a hold of. And if they had a movie that would perform okay, they would program it endlessly. 'Cause I remember this always being on like TBS or TNT. So I just saw it a lot as a kid, you know, usually kind of piecemeal, flipping through the channels and then landing on it and being like, what's this? Oh, a Stephen King thing? Okay. So that's part of it. But I've also found it very interesting for, as a person who loves the Stephen King, you know, body of work and film adaptations and stuff, I found it interesting because this is, according to the the theatrical released poster, the actual tagline they have is the first Stephen King story written expressly for the screen. So I was like, oh, it's his first time, you know, writing an outright screenplay that's not based on something that he previously wrote. So I always found that intriguing, and, you know, wouldn't know this at the time, but this is the first Stephen King project that director Mick Garris is involved with. There was actually another director on Sleepwalkers, Rupert Wainwright, who left the project and because he was changing a bunch of the script and stuff. And Stephen King actually had director approval and had some pretty significant oversight on the production. And so when they got rid of Wainwright, they had Mick Garris come on, and King and Garris apparently just really hit it off. And Garris has gone on to, I want to say, make like 6 or 7 more Stephen King adaptations after Sleepwalkers. So it's kind of important for that very particular relationship. But at the end of the day, I also like Sleepwalkers because it's kind of a glorious, unapologetic B movie.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you brought up Mick Garris, because I wanted to definitely talk about his role just within the Stephen King universe in general a little here, because I think the big thing that he did was The Stand in 1994, which I'll be getting to soon-ish. And then he did The Shining remake because Stephen King wasn't happy with Kubrick's version. So he did the 1997 version of The Shining. And I'm sure he did more after that because he's definitely someone who is still very prominent in the horror community. If anyone hasn't checked out his podcast, Postmortem, I highly recommend checking that out. You can sort of pick and choose episodes based on who the guest is, but he had Stephen King on an episode and I was like, I have to listen to this. And I think he's really just found a way to stick around and ingrain himself in the horror community, regardless of whether or not he's making movies or doing podcasts with Fangoria, I believe, is where Postmortem is sort of hosted. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that he's done in the genre in general. And I wouldn't say Sleepwalkers is his best work. And that's, you know, me saying that not having seen the other stuff yet. But I've heard a lot about the 1994 version of The Stand. And I think for me, Sleepwalkers just isn't totally up my alley. It's one of those concepts where I was like, okay, this is a little too weird for me. Plus, I'm not a cat person. So all of these cats, no thank you. Go away. I would just be sneezing the whole time.
Right. So you felt more for the actual Sleepwalkers because they hate the cats. So.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Mick Garris is, you know, he got his start in the business kind of doing publicity. And he has kind of been this like luckiest fan ever kind of guy who's been really responsible for keeping a lot of horror directors in touch with each other. And you can even see that in this movie. There are cameos from John Landis and, of course, Stephen King himself, but also Clive Barker, Toby Hooper, Joe Dante.
Yes.
They all show up, and it's a fun little, you know, hey, so he's very responsible for that. And I thank him for it. Sleepwalkers, you know, the basics of the story for anyone who doesn't know is that it's about this mother and son who are actually these nomadic, shape-shifting, vampiric creatures that have to basically survive by ingesting the life essence of virginal women. And King's script, it's so interesting because I never thought about this when I was a kid, but watching it as an adult, King's script is written to be kind of timeless. Like, the movie doesn't feel like it takes place in any particular era other than, you know, choices like, yeah, that's a certain model of car or this particular song is utilized. It doesn't feel like it takes place in the 90s. It has kind of a timeless feel about it. And I actually think that's benefited the movie as far as its longevity goes.
Yeah, I think what they did well with this, though, is they kind of got the look down. And even if the story isn't necessarily the greatest thing ever, I was honestly fairly impressed with how they handled the shapeshifters. And again, like you said, I probably felt for them a little more than most because of my dislike of cats. And I was watching it, I was like, that is so many cats to have in a shot. And how do you even control that many cats? And I was like, please let all the cats go away. But they made it fun, at least, by putting in all of those cameos you mentioned. And I believe Mark Hamill was even in the opening scene, but he was uncredited in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in the kind of the setup where we see the last place that the Sleepwalkers were at, which is kind of a wonderful setup to the tone the movie's going to have, because, you know, we see Mark Hamill and this other cop talking, and Mark Hamill goes, you know, he said, has a line that's something to the effect of, they must have really hated cats. The camera pans over and we just see a bunch of cats hanging from a tree, like gutted and bloody. And I'm like, this is horribly gruesome. And just the delivery of, they must have hated cats, is so blunt and silly.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the dichotomy of the movie. And I was looking up, you know, reviews at the time and contemporary reviews of the movie. And a common thread that I found were people saying that the movie has kind of a sharp divide, and that in the beginning, it's a little more toned down, and it's weird, and it doesn't quite have the air of being a campy B-horror movie. And then the second half goes kind of full tilt into all of that stuff. I don't really have that problem with the movie. I think that actually is kind of, again, to its benefit. I think one of the best things about the movie is, hands down, the casting. This is a movie that is so incredibly small. Like, it's a really small movie. And so you have to pinpoint kind of perfect casting, because your movie really is only going to rely on three or four characters at most. And I think Sleepwalkers really knocks it out of the park, especially in regards to Madchen Amick, who's the lead character, Tanya, and then Alice Krieg as the mother in the Sleepwalker pair. I think those two are phenomenal casting.
I really enjoyed the casting for this as well. I was like, oh, you know, look at this young Madchen, because I had most recently seen her in Riverdale for however many seasons that's been going on for now. So it was this nice little treat to get to see these familiar faces in this movie. And then I really think the plot was kind of the downfall of it. But what do you think would have helped make the story a little bit better so that it would sort of kind of level up and meet the status of the casting?
I think a big issue with the movie for a lot of people is that it is a straightforward B movie. It's not really kind of fleshing itself out. And like for example, the sleepwalkers as creatures, we get kind of a dictionary definition of the term that opens the movie and kind of tells us everything we need to know about them. But we don't really get into kind of the more interesting possibilities. There's hints, for example, Brian Krause, who plays the son, Charles, mentions something to the effect of to his mother, like, we don't even know if there are any other sleepwalkers out there, like, we could be the last ones. And it's like, oh, that's a really fascinating little story tidbit to throw down. Like, maybe these are the last of their kind. Obviously, I think there's going to be an icky threshold for a lot of people, because this is a movie where the story focuses on a mother and son incestual relationship right out the gate. That is going to be tough, I understand, for a lot of people to get over and try and even maybe look at these characters sympathetically, because they are the villains and they act campy and villainous as the movie goes on. But I wish there was a little bit more kind of hinted at. I didn't want, you know, a whole, you know, I didn't want like the we got to go to the library scene and look up sleepwalkers kind of stuff. But I like those hints at the past. But otherwise, the movie is kind of just the straightforward story as far as kind of a vampire hunting down a victim, picking her out and seducing her and eventually trying to feed on her for 90 minutes. For all the weird kind of flavoring the movie has, it's a really basic story.
I certainly would have loved a little more complexity to the story, because I feel like maybe that would have toned down the campiness of the whole thing a little bit and really allowed you to sort of resonate with the characters even more.
Yeah, I would have liked some more complexity, because the interesting complexity that they throw in but pretty much gets abandoned once the third act kicks in is this idea that Charles, the son sleepwalker, is starting to fall in love with Tanya, and that this is creating a rift between him and his mother, because she's like, we need her, we have to feed on her, I'm starving, you have to feed me. And this idea that maybe this is going to be, you know, the girl that kind of breaks them apart could have been something to play with. That's the thing. I think there's way more interesting things hinted at in little bits of dialogue than are actually followed through with in the movie. Like, for example, Charles, you know, starts to get found out and he has to kill to protect his identity. He goes back and, you know, cries to his mom, like, you know, it's all happening again, and it's happening even sooner than it did last time. We're going to have to be on the run again. This implied history is really, really something that could have a lot of meat on it. But the movie, again, it's all just flavoring. It never really gets into the substance of it.
Exactly. And I think, you know, Mary was almost like a Norma Bates in this situation. Her son is sort of pulling away from her, and because of her needs and her wants, she just keeps trying to prevent him from sort of living a slightly more normal life. Obviously, it's never totally going to be normal, and it really just felt like you could tell that there were some Hitchcock influences in this, but they weren't pulled off nearly as well as Hitchcock pulls them off.
No.
Which, you know, that's hard to do. Most people can't even come close. So that's fair. That's fine. And it really just felt like she was this overbearing mother who wanted things to remain the same way they had always been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, they have this, even though this house that they just moved into, you know, is relatively new for them, it looks very old and ancient. And, you know, they're listening to an old song, you know, Sleepwalking, and when they dance together. I love Alice Krieg's performance. Like, she really does feel ethereal and like some other kind of being. So I think that's one of the best pieces of casting. You talk about the direction, kind of the Hitchcock stuff. Mick Garris is a good director. Like, he's solid. I think his best movie is probably his debut film, which was Critters 2. And I don't just say that because it's a Critters movie and I love the Critters movies. It's also, I don't think he has a particular flair or style. Like, that doesn't mean the movie is without flair or style as far as Sleepwalkers is concerned, but it's workmanlike in a good way. That said, I think because it doesn't have that sharp style, it can seem kind of bland, but something that I definitely think is worth commenting on with Sleepwalkers is the effects work in this movie, which I think is pretty good.
Yeah, I was impressed with how they were able to just make the shape-shifting come to life, and you can tell that they put a lot of effort into those effects because it was really the main thing you were trying to get across with these characters and who they are.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that early morphing effects, which, you know, it's clear that it's an effect, but I think it works okay. For example, the car that he's driving, that Charles is driving, is a blue Trans Am, and he's on the run from a police officer, so he has to shapeshift it into a red Mustang, and it's like, yeah, that looks good, and with some good sound design, it pulls off. I think that's also, and I'm not a stickler for this stuff all the time, but in this particular instance, I think it pops through, is we don't get the greatest read on what the Sleepwalkers' abilities are.
Yeah.
It's clear that they can shapeshift. We see that throughout the movie, but in to what lengths is not really clear. Could they look like other people? Or I'm not exactly, that's never clear. The mother, Alice Krieg's character, calls one of their abilities, she calls it the ability to dim. She's like, you have to dim yourself, which is pretty much turning invisible.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, well, but then it's like, well, she can turn invisible and he can turn invisible, but he can also turn his car invisible. You know, what level of concentration does this take? All that kind of stuff. It's never, again, I don't need the library scene where we read the set of exact rules on how everything works.
Yeah.
But I think it could have been presented in a more organic way and to just kind of better define what exactly the limitations of their powers were. Because I was, you know, wondering, I'm like, could they just turn, like, shapeshift to look like different people to stay on the run? Or I guess not. And they're actually these weird fleshy cat monsters that like that you can see the fleshy cat monsters in reflections. Like there's a scene where Tanya comes over to Charles's house and we see his mother's reflection in a mirror, and it's the creepy fleshy cat monster thing, but she doesn't see it. I'm like, oh, so I guess that's kind of a riff on, you know, the vampire piece of mythology about it. You can't see their reflections in a mirror. It's like, well, this one you'd see what they really are. Okay, but like that's the only time that kind of ever is shown in the movie. There's part of me that likes all this weird stuff. Like I keep saying, is flavoring, because it's a flavor. I'm like, yeah, this is cool and weird and intriguing, but the movie kind of only ever does that. It never dives into the deep end with that stuff.
Yeah, the rules are very convoluted in this, and it seems like movies either go that direction with it or the direction you mentioned where they literally lay it out for you word for word practically. And it's probably hard to find that fine line where you can just show people what the rules are. And I'm guessing with the car, because he was touching it, he could shapeshift that. But then it's like, okay, do they have to touch someone to be able to shapeshift and look like that person? Or do they just have to see them? There were so many different ways they were going about shapeshifting. And you mentioned the thing with the mirror where we could see their true selves, but they couldn't. And I was kind of like, okay, so they kind of just get to do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want. And you were kind of left wondering, well, what are their limitations then? Why are they always on the run if they can just so easily disguise themselves?
Yeah, right. Or disappear. And obviously, I'm assuming that they're, you know, making up fake names for wherever they go and so forth.
Yeah.
But I think the movie would, I don't think I would have that kind of attention drawn to those issues if the main part of the movie, which is this kind of budding romance between Tanya and Charles, if that was kind of more complicated, I think that would, because it really is just a very kind of by the book, boy meets girl, flirtatious kind of thing. And I, you know, I like that the female character is the one whose kind of perspective we're given into that. Like it's really from her perspective. And Mad Shenamic is just so good. The scene introducing her where she's working at the movie theater and dancing, I'm like, I immediately like this person. Like she's very, you know, wonderful girl next door type, you know, archetype of a character. But I there's just no complication. I like this movie actually quite a bit, but I think a big criticism for it is that it really is exactly what it seems to be. There's pretty much no surprises to be had with this movie in terms of how it's going to play out. The surprise in that regard comes to, I think, the tonal shift in the second half of the movie, or more appropriately, the third act. The tonal shift is where it just goes full on, you know, drive-in monster movie wacky.
Yeah, and I felt like they just didn't do quite enough with giving us more details. That's something that Stephen King does so well with his novels, and sometimes to a detriment. You know, some of his novels get a little too lengthy and you're like, okay, we could have used a few less details. And something like this, it feels like it's too simple to be a Stephen King story. And that's what confused me about it. I was like, oh, okay, it's over. We're done. We're good. That's it. And because I've been reading so many of his books, and he always, well, not always, but a lot of times he'll like toss in an epilogue that you kind of aren't expecting based on how the book ends before that. And you're like, oh, that was a choice. And that's kind of how I felt about this movie. Oh, that was a choice. And I'm not really sure what he was trying to get across with this movie in particular. Usually he has some sort of commentary going on, and I guess the sleepwalkers are kind of the outsiders and they're not really welcome. They're constantly causing trouble, that sort of thing. But it didn't feel like it went any deeper than that.
No, I think you bring up a good point in terms of that, because of Stephen King's status as, I would argue, not only the premier horror author of all time, but one of the premier American authors of all time. I think there is an expectation that whatever he's doing, there's always going to be more to it than just the surface. And this is kind of the movie that I think acts as a good reminder that you got to remember, Stephen King is was a dorky boy who grew up watching, you know, these 50s and 60s horror movies. And I think Sleepwalkers is kind of one of his more straightforward, dorky, I just wanted to make a B horror movie movies.
Yeah.
And I think that is disappointing because it's like there's so much here. The potential of the story is so apparent where it's like you have some really cool ideas here, but you're not really going beyond the surface, like, which is what we kind of expect when Stephen King plays with genre, is like, yeah, we'll have these fun genre elements that draw us in, but there will be a lot more to kind of dig into. But that's not the case with Sleepwalkers. Like with Sleepwalkers, what you see is what you get. And I think that is kind of a turnoff to people who expect a higher quality or at least just more to chew on with a Stephen King story. And this doesn't really provide that. But knowing that, I can kind of enjoy this as just a drive-in B-horror movie, especially when we get to the third act and really kind of the gore starts getting flung around like crazy. Yeah. And we have weird cat people transformations and, you know, cops are getting pencils shoved into their ears.
It's a brutal third act.
Yeah, well, to which Charles has the... could not have been written by anybody else but Stephen King. He has the one-liner cop kebab, which I'm just like, all right, Big Steve. That's something that would interest me too, is that because this seemed like it's like, oh man, we're going to get Stephen King writing a movie first and we're going to give him director approval and obviously give him a good deal amount of oversight on the movie. Because I know that Stephen King sometimes desperately needs a good editor, I wonder if this script is like a second draft or something, because it feels like a first or second draft where you've got this really cool main idea, but you're just executing it kind of as textbook as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That you're not finding the really interesting, stickier parts of the story and playing around with that, because there's plenty to do as far as the potential of the story. But this also does feel like it was made to be an effects showcase movie. And that's one of the areas where I'm surprised that this movie has such a bad reputation, because I think as an effects horror movie from the early 90s, I think it's kind of a fun time.
Yeah. I almost want like a reverse adaptation of this, because more often than not, the Stephen King TV shows and movies that we're talking about have stemmed from stories of his or novels. And I almost want him to write like a short story or novella on this and expand on these characters, because there is something there. And like you said, the direction they went, it ended up being more of an effects showcase, which is fine. Sometimes you just want to watch a horror movie and see what they did with the effects. And I've been slacking the last few days because of my move on watching a horror movie a day. We're recording this on the 15th here, so I'm hoping to start that back up today. I've skipped 3 days, I think. And a lot of the horror movies I've been watching, it's not necessarily that they have some fantastic storyline to them. It's just you want to sit down and watch a horror movie. You want to watch people be scared regardless of what the story is.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons I love why horror is my favorite genre is that you can make a horror story that can kind of coast and succeed on the basis of a really good premise. Like, that's all you need, is a really good premise for some horror stories. If your premise is fun or unique enough, you can kind of get by with that. And I kind of think that's what Sleepwalkers does, is it's like, yeah, this gets by on a pretty basic vampire type structure. And then it has all this other weird flavoring. But because it's Stephen King, there's this added level of expectation. Yeah. of quality of like, well, wait, this is Stephen King. Like, if he's going to do this kind of movie, there's going to be, you know, way more going on. There's going to be profoundly great acting or a really sharp, you know, directorial style or some really in-depth kind of surprising commentary. And pretty much with the exception of really good acting, which, you know, it's graded on a curve, because this is really good acting in a purposeful B-horror kind of monster fest.
Yeah.
I don't think those things are really present in Sleepwalkers. It just is. It's like, no, like it feels weirdly for Stephen King like a lark. Like if this was a 20-minute section in Creepshow, you know, I think we'd be like, oh, that's like one of the best Creepshow, you know, ideas. If it just started off from the Tanya character's perspective of meeting this boy and he's a total dreamboat and I'm in love with him. And, you know, now I'm meeting his mom and she seems really nice, but wow, they live in an old house. And the big surprise at the end of the Creepshow segment is, ta-da, we're fleshy cat vampire people. I think people would be like, oh, wow, that was really fun. But because this is an hour and a half, you know, plus whatever movie, it doesn't seem like it needs to be in that format. It seems like you're saying like a short story or a novella in terms of what the actual story is trying to do. One thing I do have to comment on before we eventually wrap things up is the use of the Enya song is kind of the movie's theme, which it is that more than anything else from this movie is the thing that stuck with me as a kid. Like, I remember it playing for the first time in the openings of the movie and just being so creeped out and mesmerized by this really somber Enya track and being like, whoa, what is that? And like trying to, you know, find out what the song was. And funny enough, Mick Garris, apparently the Sony music branch or whatever, basically gave him a bunch of songs. They're like, we want you to feature something. So here, and he hated all these, like, none of these are good. And then he landed on that Enya one and he's like, this is the only thing they gave me that even remotely seemed like it could fit in with the movie that we're doing. And he's like, cause there's no lyrics. It's just humming like all this stuff. So I always, as soon as I think of Sleepwalkers, that tune starts playing in my head. But yeah, I totally see why Sleepwalkers isn't really beloved. Like I get it, but I look at it and it's just, it's always, I see, you know, called one of the worst Stephen King movies. I'm like, you guys, there's way more Stephen
debatable.
King. Yeah. I mean, if we're counting everything that's even, you know, ancillary.
TV movies and I would say
Children
this,
of the Corns.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. This that, has like, not been the worst thing I've watched so far. I can tell you that between the theatrical releases, the TV movies, the TV series. Definitely not the worst thing I have seen, but it's also something that I probably don't really plan on revisiting all that often because there are so many other fantastic Stephen King adaptations that I think just grab me way more than this did. And, you know, that's fine. You can like whatever movies you want, even if they're bad. You know, Maximum Overdrive is by far a bad movie, but it's so much fun at the same time.
Ridiculously entertaining. I would watch that movie in a heartbeat. it's so goofy. But yeah, I think Sleepwalkers, like on the drive-in movie scale, like I would give this a solid 3 stars.
Okay.
Like it's like this is a fine enough, you know, tacky little B horror movie that's surprisingly well put together. Like it's not a bad looking movie. I don't think the effects are horrendous at all. I think they're actually pretty good, especially for the time being. It's not going to surprise you in any way. The story is going to play out exactly how you think it is. And yeah, that is disappointing, but it's all executed on a really good level. I would say that it just has kind of this burden of, you know, marketing of being it's Stephen King's first movie that he's written.
Right.
Like it's like, oh, that's got to be great. It's like, no, he wanted to make an ode to the kind of B horror movies that he grew up watching and didn't want to do anything deeper than that. And that's fine. Like it.
Yeah.
That's okay. Like not everything has to be a magnum opus. Like he can do the kind of these little larks. So I kind of hope that Sleepwalkers is starting to get a little bit like of a rehabilitation. I mean, there's some people that even responded to me saying like, oh, this is like one of the worst Stephen King adaptations. And I'm like, it's not an adaptation. Like this is, he wrote this purely on his own.
Yeah.
So yeah, I can't come out and say that it is, you know, it's like, oh, this is an undiscovered or underappreciated gem that you all don't know, you know, that you're treating this great movie like it's trash. It's like, nah, it's not a great movie. It's a good one. And it's okay for movies to just be good, even Stephen King ones.
Yeah. Apparently, I didn't actually end up rating this on Letterboxd at the time when I had watched it, but I think right now I'm sitting at somewhere around a 2, 2.5.
Okay.
Which isn't horrible. I think I gave like a Return to Salem's Lot a half star, maybe 1 star. Like, it's not the worst thing I've seen by far, especially in the Stephen King world. So it's just one of those things where subject matter wise, I went into it, I was like, okay, shapeshifters, lots of cats, not really my thing on either account, but the casting and the acting kind of leveled it up a little for me, and I can appreciate the effects work that was done throughout. So I think it's one of those things, if you haven't seen it, I would recommend checking it out just so you can sort of form your own opinion on it, because while there are a ton of Stephen King movies and TV shows and things to check out, sometimes you just have to watch some of the bad ones to get perspective. And I wouldn't say this is bad. It's kind of middle of the road, which you're going to have those every now and then. It's not like I went into this podcast expecting everything to be fantastic.
Yeah, if I was going to kind of categorize this in the greater Stephen King filmography, I'd say this is like a B-side. Like a really deep cut B-side track where it's like, yeah, he did this one thing and it's not going to be for everybody. It's not going to be, you know, as notable as a lot of the other pieces of this work, but he did the thing that he wanted to do. Like, that's something I've always kind of really loved about Sleepwalkers, is like, for better or worse, this is the movie that Stephen King wanted.
Yeah,
it happened. So it's, you know, I think the worst thing about Sleepwalkers is that because it was so heavily marketed on being Stephen King's writing a movie for the first time, and it performed poorly and was not, you know, critically well received, it kind of tanked a lot of his potential for working specifically in screenwriting. I mean, he would go on to do other screenwriting stuff and found a wonderful home doing those TV miniseries, which you'll get to in the 90s.
Yes, there are many.
Yes. But yeah, I think this movie doesn't deserve the kind of... I see it listed as like, oh, this is the worst Stephen King movies and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, no, I think this is fine. But when we're talking about Stephen King, especially in film, fine is not going to be acceptable for a lot of people. And so then it just rates to being bad. And it's like, no, I think this is good. I think there's some good things about it. I just think, like we said in the episode, I think the worst thing that it does is just kind of executing itself on a surface level. There's nothing really beyond that to enjoy or dig into.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's a perfect place to wrap this up. Before we go, though, I do want to quickly let you all know about our Patreon. You can support this podcast for $1 a month. That'll get you a thank you on the show. $2 a month will get you a Chat Cemetery sticker. And you can find us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter and Instagram. Drew, thank you for joining me to talk about this. I'm glad you had a chance to defend this movie.
Yeah, that's I'm always here to defend the movies. Nobody else will.
And to our listeners, as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.